Okay, cool. Thanks for coming. My name's Matt. A plan, rough plan anyway, is to talk for maybe half an hour. That could go on longer than that or go much more quickly. And then maybe like 20 minutes, half an hour for a bit of a discussion if people fancy that. So the title's Elephants, Dogmas and Taboos, Friendly Critique of Anarchism. It's friendly because I do consider myself an anarchist. It's broadly supportive of anarchism, and I'm not challenging, not suggesting that anarchism isn't viable or isn't something that we should pursue. But it is critical. It is a critique of lots of anarchist assumptions, what I've called elephants, referring to elephants in the room, dogmas and taboos. So I'm not going to look explicitly and suggest that one thing is a dogma or one thing is a taboo. But what I want to kind of highlight is the fact that there are quite a lot of problems in anarchist thought. But going beyond that, to highlight the fact that they're not just problems, they're problems that aren't generally being addressed, and there's lots of things that within kind of day-to-day anarchist discussions or the anarchist common sense, if you like, there's lots of things that we tend not to discuss, that we tend to kind of, that are a bit taboo or that we kind of accept as obvious truths without kind of critically examining them, or kind of dogmatically agree to, and so on. So it's that kind of thing that I want to highlight. There are obviously lots of debates within anarchism and lots of people disagreeing, but in a way I think it's kind of there's a parallel to what people like Chomsky talk about in terms of liberal capitalism, where you've got these supposed big ideological debates between Labour and Tories, but clearly they're all happening within the parameters of liberal capitalism, and no one's really challenging the basic assumptions of liberal capitalism. So although within anarchism you've got big debates about, I don't know, black bloc tactics or lifestyle or class or whatever, there are still lots of kind of underlying assumptions that generally don't get challenged or explored. And it's not necessarily to say that a lot of the things that anarchists tend to believe are necessarily wrong or necessarily problematic, but I think if we don't think about why they're, you know, well, why we think these things, and constantly re-kind of examine things in light of changing circumstances in the world, politically, philosophically, culturally. If we don't kind of keep on top of those things, then they do become these kind of dogmatic beliefs that we just accept the state's bad, and we just accept it, and we don't kind of keep on thinking why. okay. So we've got these kind of problems that we don't tend not to discuss. I'm going to discuss those in the second part, but in the first part I'm going to discuss some of the reasons why I think it's the case that anarchism has got this kind of block to kind of looking at these problems. Some of these things are similar within other ideologies, and some of them are specific to anarchism. But I think it's important to understand why the problem exists and not just to look at the problem itself. And before I start, I want to stress that in critiquing something, you don't necessarily say that it's completely flawed and that therefore we have to adopt another way of thinking. We tend to kind of dichotomise things. We tend to think about if you criticise anarchism, then you must be a liberal or a communism. Or if you criticise the state, then you've got to be against it. If you criticise equality, then you've got to be for hierarchy or whatever. But criticising something, and I'm going to criticise a few anarchist ideas, but it doesn't mean that we have to reject them entirely. We can still see that they're problematic. We can still see that they've got flaws without therefore saying, okay, well, so we've got to kind of completely reject them. And that seems like a really obvious point, but quite often if you say something is, you know, if you say, oh, anarchism's got a problem with crime, it doesn't know how to deal with crime, people will say, oh yeah, but look at how bad the state is. But, you know, to say there's a problem with anarchism and crime doesn't mean necessarily you support the state. So it's kind of, rather than just saying, well, the alternative's worse, it's worth kind of focusing on the problems we've got, even if it means sticking more or less with that idea. Okay, so first half I'm going to kind of flick through some reasons for this kind of this slightly dogmatic taboo kind of approach to problems. And that in a way is the first one on the list, really. This creation of a black and white ideological identity where you have, you're an anarchist, so you can't criticise anarchist thoughts, because if you do, then you'll be a bit of a liberal or you'll be a bit of a reformist. And so things tend to be kind of made quite black and white, and if things are criticised, then people are seen to be kind of veering over to the other side. And this happens in all ideologies and all cultures. We like kind of strict boundaries, we like strict parameters, we tend not to like grey areas, even though anarchists, and this is one of the reasons why I've done this paper, is because anarchists are quite proud of being non-ideological and being non-sectarian and non-dogmatic, and I find that quite interesting, because generally I don't find it very true. But there's a whole lot of rhetoric within anarchism about us being non-ideological. I don't know if anyone's come across this game of bingo that anarchists sometimes play at non-anarchist events, whereby you write down a load, like if you go to a socialist party conference or something, you write down a load of words that that you know that the socialists are going to say, and then you cross them off as and when people say them. And the idea is to kind of mock the ideological conformity of the speakers, because you know they're going to use certain words and certain phrases. And that was a game that anarchists were playing, like certainly the turn of this century. But I think it's quite arrogant, really, and quite self-delusional, because I think quite clearly you could play that game at an Earth First gathering or at this book fair with anarchists. There are certain terms that we use, and there's not necessarily any problem with that. Ideologies are kind of necessarily slightly self-contained, and we have to have points of references, and we have to have agreements, otherwise we wouldn't be here. We have certain ideas, but it's about kind of whether we can challenge those and whether we just accept them without argument. Anarchists tend to think that they don't, but I think quite often they do. Okay, so just a quick further thing on ideology. I mean, I've talked about ideology a lot. Again, there's this idea that anarchism is not an ideology. I don't see that makes any sense, really. There's two ways you can understand ideology, roughly. I mean, there's lots of ways, but being ideological in the kind of negative sense of being very blind, but then ideology in the sense of just having a kind of worldview and having a shared worldview. And any worldview kind of is necessarily self-contained to some degree, and I think we shouldn't reject that. I think we should just kind of reject the sense of being ideological in this kind of blind, dogmatic way. And so that's kind of what this is trying to do a bit. Another reason is anarchism, as we all know, I'm sure, is subject to a lot of very negative and very crude reductionist critiques, primarily in the media. So whenever there's chaos in an African state and there's a civil war, it's anarchy. Whenever people are throwing bricks through windows in a European protest, they're anarchists. There's a great picture in I think it was the Metro a few months ago, when the student protests, people stood outside one of the buildings that was being occupied, and there was a great crowd of people in front of the building. There was a globalised resistance flag, which is part of the kind of Socialist Workers' Party thing, and a Communist Party of Great Britain flag, and the tagline was "Anarchists storm building." And we're all familiar with that kind of easy rhetoric. And we're fed up with it, and we don't want to add to that kind of chorus of negative voices. We don't want to just kind of, and we become defensive, and we're also aware that there's a kind of this idea of divide and conquer. We don't want to be kind of infighting. We don't want to spend all our time challenging each other and ignoring the kind of wider problem out there. So we've got this kind of defensive attitude, which is understandable. And of course, we don't want to spend all our time criticising one another. But if it's also necessary to challenge our own opinions and other anarchist opinions. And a kind of corollary of that is that this, there tends not to be much constructive criticism of anarchism. If you look at other ideologies, there's lots of debates between them and other ideologies. Whatever you think about liberalism, the kind of theory of liberalism has progressed a lot in the last 30, 40 years because it's listened to critiques of feminism, post-colonialism, queer theory, communitarianism, post-structuralism. And so the theory, at least, has kind of changed a lot and progressed because people from the outside have said, well, look at these problems, you know, and challenge them. And anarchism tends not to have that because generally, people interested in anarchism, they're anarchists, and so they're supportive of it. People who aren't anarchists tend not to be that supportive of it because it's always been a very marginalised philosophy or politics. So it doesn't have kind of much helpful creative output from the outside. That's, I mean, it's not strictly true. It does occur, but not a great deal. Okay, another reason, this is kind of quite a strange one, and this is one that I was thinking of particularly to say that just because I'm going to criticise something doesn't mean we have to reject it. But there's a real emphasis on being egalitarian and equal within anarchism. And that can result in problems. There's a real emphasis on equality of speaking and talking, and this talk now is obviously an example of that not being the case, and you all sat here patiently listening to me, but in lots of anarchist scenes this would be really frowned on, and I've done workshops where I've spoken for like 5 minutes and then spent 55 minutes doing like discussion and workshops, and I've been told I've spoken too much, and this I did a workshop a few months ago with a friend, and it was this kind of radicalism day that someone else organised, and they'd asked us to come along and talk about anarchism, and most of the people who came to this day didn't really know much about anarchism. They came to learn about anarchism, and my friend was basically refused to talk about anarchism, and he was saying, I want to hear what you've got to say, I want to hear what other people have got to say, and everyone was too polite to say, well, we've come here to hear what you've got to say, we don't have anything to say, that's why we're here to learn. So this is real emphasis on, you know, everyone having like an equal voice, and no one being the kind of authority, no one being able in a position of hierarchy to lecture other people or to kind of preach to other people. And that's understandable. That comes from obviously rejection of like hierarchies of knowledge and power and so on, and it makes sense, and certainly if you're in a meeting it makes sense to try and give people an equal voice. But of course, giving people an equal voice doesn't necessarily give opinions an equal airing. So if you've got 12 people in a room and 11 of them are completely up for direct action and blockading an oil refinery, and that's, you know, that's the plan, and one person is opposed to that, and you give them all 5 minutes, then you've had like an equal say with the people, but the plan to blockade the refinery has had 55 minutes and the alternative plan has had 5 minutes. And again, we recognise this within kind of like critiques of the media, whereby someone defending Israel and someone defending Palestine, they both have 5 minutes. It's not an equal voice because one argument is already kind of much more in the public consciousness. And that's true within anarchism. So giving everyone an equal say, an equal time to speak, means that people who are kind of critical of ideas and want to challenge things often don't, that idea doesn't get enough time to kind of be established. And there's not necessarily a really obvious way to deal with that, but I think it's worth thinking about. Kind of related to that, also a rejection of theory and academia. Again, I think book fairs tend to be an example of where that's not always the case, but certainly in lots of activism, anarchist cultures, there's a real rejection of theory, and particularly academic theory and people who are academics. And there's this kind of real emphasis on practice and doing things. There's an Earth First banner that's often put up at Earth First events, which is a Gerard Winstanley quote. He says, "My mind was not at rest because nothing was acted and thoughts run in me. The words and writing were all nothing and must die." And that's been kind of used by Earth First for quite a long time now. It's been used by Schnooze, used by lots of kind of anarchists. And there is this real culture of words are a waste of time, we need to act. But obviously there's a real irony there that you've got a banner like with words written by someone who died like 400 years ago saying words are meaningless, we need to act. And clearly words aren't meaningless because they're using those words to say something. But that aside, there's a kind of general resistance to people discussing things. I should have said at the beginning actually that there are very, very different anarchist kind of cultures. I've come personally from a kind of activist scene where I've been involved in things like Dissent and Earth First. I'm also an academic working on anarchist stuff. Go to lots of things like book fairs and so on. But there are different anarchist scenes and cultures and so on. So some of this might ring really true to some people and might not to other people. But certainly in some of the scenes that I've been involved with, there's a real kind of rejection of ever discussing things. And that's a problem because theory throws up things that we don't experience in practice because we don't live in an anarchist society, so we don't know how things are going to work out. And so if we just focus on practice, then some of the kind of issues that we might expect or we might anticipate in an anarchist society aren't necessarily going to come up. Okay, so the last kind of reason for these taboos and dogmas, which is also a bit of a taboo itself, is, and this kind of relates to the theory thing, is the rejection of blueprints. And this is a very deeply widespread view within anarchism, is that you don't create blueprints for an alternative society. And again, this comes from very kind of reasonable, well thought out rejections of hierarchies of knowledge and power and the problems of creating a universal plan that fits everyone. Anarchism's supposed to be localised, it's supposed to be kind of grassroots from the bottom up, and the idea of making a plan that fits everything is seen as being deeply problematic, and rightly so. But it's come to the point now where, certainly in my view, any kind of discussion of a hypothetical anarchist future and the problems that we might anticipate occurring in that society are just rejected outright because we don't kind of create blueprints. And similarly, any difficult questions that anarchists face are kind of shielded with this kind of "I don't create blueprints" kind of get out of jail free card. So when people say, "Well, how would anarchists, run the economy, or how would anarchists deal with crime?" Quite often, and I've heard this, and it certainly comes up in writing and so on. Oh, well, that's not for me to say. An anarchist society will answer it itself, which is fair enough. But the question is, could you answer it? Like, if you're in that anarchist society, could you answer it? Do you have an answer that you're willing to tell me? And my fear is that when people say, "Oh, that's not for me to say," what they really mean, whether they realise it or not, is, "Well, I haven't got a fucking clue, actually. I don't know how we would deal with those things." And we'll just wait until the anarchist society arrives, and then we'll deal with it, which is fair enough. But then we have to accept that maybe we won't deal with it so well. Maybe it won't be such a great society. Okay, so that's just a kind of very brief. I'm running too slowly, but that's a kind of brief overview of some of the reasons why we've got these barriers to challenging anarchism, to challenging ourselves, to challenging each other. Like I say, some of them are kind of related specifically to anarchism. Some of them are just more about ideologies, cultures, and the way they tend to kind of reinforce one another. And none of this is absolute. It's all just about a kind of network of reasons that congeal to kind of create a general resistance. Clearly, there are examples where this is not true, and this book fair is a good example of that. Okay, so some of the things that we tend not to talk about, and I'm going to run through these fairly quickly. Voting and more broadly the idea of reform, and more broadly again the idea of working with government. I think this is a bit of a taboo, and it's a bit of a kind of a grey area where people really, it's not really discussed, except I've found in kind of one-to-one conversations. But obviously, on the face of it, there's an anarchist rejection of voting, and every election there's normally stickers on bins, certainly where I live, saying, you know, don't vote, it only encourages them, or vote bollocks, or all the, you know, these kind of standard rejections of voting. And clearly anarchism on its basic level is a rejection of involvement with the state, and it's a rejection of reform of the state. But anarchists have also, or increasingly, reject the idea of revolution, in at least understood as a cataclysmic event that happens, you know, over the space of a week or a year, where the power is overthrown and there's a kind of violent struggle to change society. Most anarchists have rejected the idea that that's a kind of progressive, useful, or even likely way of changing the world. But this idea of reform, the idea of voting, whether certain parties are better than other people, others, whether certain individuals, whether certain states are better than others, certain policies, tends to be something that anarchists, I find, are really uncomfortable talking about. But when pushed, I think most people do accept that there are better states than others, that there are better politicians than others, certainly on the local level, that there are better city councillors than others. And when I've spoken to lots of anarchists, lots of them admit that they vote for the Green councillors, or even their Green MP, or even their Labour MP to keep the Tory out. But it's something that's just kind of anarchists don't do, and so we don't discuss. And I think that's a real shame, because I think there's a real need to think about where anarchism stands in relation to the state now, and what we really anticipate. And I think there's a certain kind of degree of cowardness and maybe hypocrisy, where we have this vision of a better world, but we know, most of us feel anyway, it's not going to be realised anytime soon. And so in the meantime, we've got this state, and our politics kind of suggests that we shouldn't work with it, but we want it to be as good as possible, most of us do. There's also the counter argument that it should be as bad as possible, so that people come to see its kind of naked truth in all its horror, if you like. But I don't know many anarchists that are kind of arguing that to make the state as bad as possible, and to kind of lobby for worse legislation and vote for the BNP or the Tories. Maybe they do secretly, I don't know. But generally, I feel like there is this kind of feeling of wanting to reform things. But it's something that we just don't discuss. And I think, I don't think for me, it takes anything from the anarchist ethos, because for me, anarchism is the idea that we could live without the state, but we've got a state, and so for me, anarchism doesn't necessarily entail a complete rejection of that state whilst it exists. It entails a rejection of the idea of trying to take it over, but that there are all sorts of ways in which we can have engagements with the state in different levels, and there have been, and in the 70s particularly, there was a group that produced a pamphlet called In and Against the State, about people working within healthcare and social work and so on, and there was some really interesting debates, I think, several decades ago, and that tends to have been lost now, and it's just this bit of a silence, and I think that's a real shame. Crime, I think, is a really big one. Colin Ward often cited crime as the kind of one big reason why anarchism wasn't accepted by more people, because they just couldn't accept the fact that if you got rid of prisons and you got rid of the police force, then there would be a kind of viable social order. And it worried him greatly, and he wrote a lot about that, and felt that it was a real shame that anarchists didn't seem to want to do more to convince people of the possibilities of a reasonable level of social order without the institutions that are normally understood as being necessary to kind of create and defend that social order. But there's two levels there. There's the failure of anarchists to really make arguments to other people, to non-anarchists, to say why and how we could envisage such a world. But I think that stems from a deeper problem, which is anarchists, in my view, generally haven't got the answers themselves. There was quite an interesting, very honest pamphlet produced by Class War about 20 years ago now, called "What Do We Do When the Cops Fuck Off?" And pretty much the answer was, we don't know, but we've got to find an answer that's better than the state, than the police force. And that was produced in the 80s. So that's like after more than 100 years of anarchist activism, of writing, of thinking, of doing, people still saying, we don't really know what we're going to do if we get rid of the police force. Maybe we know what an anarchist society 100 years down the line might look like once we've got rid of deep-seated inequalities, deep-seated moral psychosis and all the rest of it. But what are we going to do like now? And what are we going to do if the state suddenly crumbles and in the intervening years? And I find it kind of upsetting, I suppose, that there's so little discussion about that, because I do think, you know, if we want to kind of promote anarchism, if we want people to take us seriously, then we do need to have some of these kind of answers, because most people, I think, quite reasonably will say, well, it's, you know, that's a nice idea in theory, but it's unless you can tell me how you're going to deal with these things, then you're not going to convince me. And Colin Ward has quite a nice kind of turn of phrase, where he says words to the effect of, we might not be concerned about our lack of, you know, we might be happy with a faith that it's going to work, but most people are not going to be happy with that faith. We need to give them something more concrete than that. Okay, so I think that's a big issue, a big kind of elephant in the room, if you like. Another one is consensus. I don't know how many people, again, this is something where there is a division within anarchist cultures, and so depending on where you kind of spend your time as an anarchist, I guess, and where you are an anarchist, you might have come across this, you might have not come across it much, you might have be completely immersed in it. Certainly in some cultures of anarchism, consensus has become pretty synonymous with anarchism. Like, there's the idea that you would do anything that wasn't done by consensus would just be unthinkable, really. And you quite often hear things like, well, we're anarchists, so we do things by consensus. And so that's interesting in itself, really, the fact that lots of anarchists have rejected consensus, and it's a relatively recent idea within, or to have been taken up by the anarchist movement. The last kind of, I mean, there's been strains of it for a long time, but it's really been the last 10 or 15 years where it's become a kind of fundamental principle for a lot of the kind of anarchism that we saw in like the anti-capitalist movement, the ultra-globalisation movement, the radical green movement, and so on. For whom consensus is just absolute. There's no scope at all to suggest that things will be done other than consensus. And at the same time, this idea that these uses of consensus in things like climate camps and these kind of temporary autonomous zones and these summit mobilisations and in social centres, the idea that consensus is basically showing people how anarchism works. It's anarchism in action, and it's providing the answers to some of the kind of questions that I've been raising of well, this is how we do things, we work by consensus. And I think this is one of the biggest problems anarchism faces at the moment is to kind of challenge that and to get away from this view that consensus is going to work, because basically what you've got is people in a field for a week who more or less agree on most things, coming to decisions about how they're going to blockade a runway by consensus, and then saying this is democracy in action, this is how we're going to organise society. And you do get pamphlets and so on, and books, and even academic books, where people quite explicitly say this is how, you know, this answers all the questions, this is how we're going to work, people are going to come to consensus, and it's worked here, so it's going to work in cities. There's one pamphlet that says there's no reason why we've basically proved that it will work in cities of tens of thousands of people, because you've had 2,000 people in a field for a week using consensus. So there's a real kind of, just I think, a real blindness to the particularities and the context of the way consensus is used, the fact that it's used by people with very kind of clear political agreement, the fact that it's used in temporary spaces where long-term questions don't arise, the fact that it's used in very specific spaces that are generally oriented already towards a kind of political goal of a kind of summit mobilisation, for example. You've already got people pretty much in a kind of working in a direction, and so. And it's debatable whether consensus works that well in those places, but even if it does, the idea that then you can kind of take it and suddenly you get everyone in Sheffield to agree to everything is, I think, really, really problematic. And I could say a lot more about that, but I'm going to kind of push on. And the last one I'm going to say is freedom, really. And I think this, in a way, is the kind of overarching issue for anarchism, and this kind of dream that anarchism can provide freedom for everyone, and I think that kind of is the root cause of a lot of our problems in challenging these other things, this kind of working with the state, with looking at crime and how we would deal with that, looking at voting and consensus, because I think at heart we just don't want to accept that we will ever be responsible for denying someone's freedom, because anarchists are about promoting freedom, and denying freedom is what communists do and liberals do and capitalists do, and we can't come to terms with the fact that, you know, our ideology might not be able to provide answers to provide a perfect freedom. And I don't think there's any real anthropological evidence or any theoretical argument that we can look to suggest that there can ever be a society where everyone can be completely free, because freedoms conflict, people's actions and values conflict, and we order societies in certain ways, and a lot of the kind of so-called primitive societies, stateless societies that people look to often to kind of say, well, look, life without the state is viable. That proves that life without the state is viable. It doesn't prove that people have absolute freedom in them, and often they don't, and often in fact they have far less freedom than people in some liberal societies, which isn't a value judgment, but it's to say that all societies kind of structure the people within them and structure their daily life in certain ways. And I think until anarchists kind of really accept that and come to terms with that and accept that they're going to deny, or they want to deny, people's freedoms, and that they're prepared to do that and to kind of discuss ways that that might happen, I think there's going to be this block to kind of assessing all these other things. And the more we come to terms with the kind of practicalities and we kind of reject this moral absolutism where we're just pure and we're not guilty of anything and we've never coerced and we've never caused harm, and the more we kind of come to a kind of realisation that the world is complex and it's messy, and we've got some ideas about how to deal with it, but it's going to be a complex and messy kind of negotiation, the more we might be a bit more open to kind of looking at our own thoughts and questioning them and seeing them as being slightly problematic. So that's it really. It's been very, very brief. I kind of wanted to focus on some of these things a lot more, but I also wanted to kind of just get a brief overview to kind of present a bit of a provocation, because there's certainly for myself like a frustration really with the anarchist movement and with lots of anarchism, that there are these doors being closed all the time, and there are these issues that just aren't being discussed, and it's this is kind of my like very humble minor attempt to kind of to push that a bit and to kind of try and shine a light on a few things, and to kind of to try and provoke a bit of debate. I'm going to have to do it in lots more places than this, but certainly you'd be interested to hear what people have thought about this and different kind of responses to the whole idea of the general idea that I presented, or to any specific issues that I've talked about in the paper.
This whole sort of fire to the prisons things, I think we've done about yesterday, and like, I haven't got a clue what would happen if, I just wonder what other people's ideas would be on an alternative justice system, or if there was any, how would we deal with kind of random nutters, murderers, rapists, understandably that some of these problems are sort of caused by inequality and the state, but it'd certainly take a little bit of long. If there was a revolution, there would be a long sort of transition, generations of sort of, like you said yourself, sort of things, assumptions and things that are kind of sort of so built in, it would, to shed those would take a long time, I wonder what other people's ideas were on that, because I don't personally have any.
I mean, there are kind of a few different strands of thinking, and there are some activist responses. There are things. There's an idea of restorative justice, which isn't just isn't predominantly an anarchist thing, but it's been taken up by some anarchists. There've been kind of so housing co-ops and communities that have tried to deal with things themselves, but it's often a very, very tiring and ultimately damaging response. I know some people who tried to deal with a sexual assault within a community, and after 2 years, the community was just completely emotionally devastated, and the general conclusion was, if this happens again, we're going to the police. One thing I've kind of thought about several times is police community support officers, and this is kind of what I mean about the idea of taboo, because I feel like if I ever said like to an anarchist, what do you think of police community support officers, there would be this kind of, oh, they're wankers, aren't they? Of course they're the police, aren't they? But these are people who've got very little, next to no legal authority. I mean, they look like the police, they look even worse than the police sometimes. But they've got no legal authority, and the kind of idea of them is that they work on a kind of cultural authority of people respecting them. And there's huge, huge problems with the way they dress and the fact that they're embedded with the police and why they've got that authority and who decides that it should be there. But there is a kind of grain of something there that's kind of, these are people who don't have the right to arrest you. They don't have that kind of capacity of the police, but they're people, they're kind of wardens. And I haven't really kind of been able to develop any thoughts about that, partly because I haven't really been able to have conversations with people about that. I think that's what I certainly want, is to, because like you say, that, it's really hard to answer these questions, and we're not going to answer them until we start talking about them, until we start having these debates. But I think generally there aren't really many answers.
Does anybody here have any ideas about that?
Well, I don't have any else, but I'm definitely, I think, guilty of when I, like, flatmates and they have no idea about anarchism before or anything, and they're like, so how does it work? I've definitely been guilty of having the sort of the bailout of saying, well, how do you want it to work? And that sort of response, because I don't want to admit it, to be honest. I don't, like, I can say a general thing, but I can give you the ins and outs of how it works or something. So I think Kropotkin in Conquest of Red is sort of like, I've been said to be one of the almost blueprints of how it could operate, but of course that's written in like sort of 1904 or whatever, so it's a bit outdated now, and so a lot has changed.
What idea was that?
Where he sort of went into like the economics of like the Paris Commune, sort of if you wanted to feed Paris, the idea is if you work out to do bread, you can. That's that you've by working out to do bread, you're not going to get people annoyed because they're not going to go hungry, but also they're not. Then you've worked out a system of how to do this like a mass thing in anarchist society, so it gives a little blueprint for how to work other things. And then he like went into all the economics of hectares, you have this, and you can feed the population, you can increase productivity and everything like that. But ultimately, it still didn't necessarily give like a response for how an anarchist society would work. It's sort of his best effort. But it's a tough question. And I don't think there is always going to be an element of we're not going to know until it necessarily happens, because also there's an element to it, I think, you don't want to discuss these issues because they'll be divisive as well, and to maintain unity, sort of just try and not say how we'd do with like crime and everything.
I haven't got any brilliant suggestions regarding crime, but I mean, in terms of the blueprint stuff, I think things have changed since then in quite a lot of ways. I think one of the best kind of blueprints or potential blueprints that exists within our society at the moment is the free software movement and the manner in which free software is produced. And the mode of production of free software is essentially one of just people doing what they want because they feel like it, and freely associating to do what they want because they feel like doing it. And out of that has come, you know, an operating system and a range of applications, well, multiple operating systems and range of applications that are dominating certain sectors of the capitalist economy. You know, most web servers are running Apache, etc., etc. There's more and more Linux devices out there, and people don't even know it. You know, you get a cable broadband connection from Virgin, and the chances are your router's going to be running Linux, even though you don't know it. You know, an awful lot of people have actually got Linux computers in their houses, and they're not even aware of it. So it is something that is challenging the most kind of the richest corporations on the planet, like, for example, Microsoft. And obviously now there are an awful lot of people that are employed by corporations to work on it, and it isn't just a product of kind of hobbyists as it was in the beginning. But still, because of the software licenses that have been used, the kind of inherent freedoms within it, the freedom with free software to do what you want with it, to give it away, to charge people for it, the only the restriction being that you are not allowed to give it to other people without also giving them the freedoms that you have. You can't make it less free. You can't give it to someone and tell them that they're not allowed to go and sell 100 copies of it. So they have the same freedoms you have. So even though there's a lot of people, you know, in the commercial world being paid to work on it, its essence is still one of basically a product of people just doing what they want, essentially, and I think that's the kind of the blueprint. And I think if the production of software can be self-organized in that manner, It's obvious that everything's designed now on computers. I mean, there must be almost nothing that's produced in the world that isn't designed on a computer, or at least worked out on a computer via spreadsheets or drawings or whatever. So the designs of everything could be free and freely shared and freely amendable and freely improvable. And, you know, the production at the moment is incredibly wasteful and ecologically destructive, but, you know, if things were designed to last and be fixable and be maintainable, then, you know, it would result in less environmental destruction and, you know... So, obviously, it could be quite easily applied to the designs of stuff. And then in terms of how stuff is made, you know, we've got the whole history of the cooperative movements and stuff like that for, you know, groups of people getting together to work on particular products, particular projects to produce stuff in a cooperative manner. And I think, to me, the whole blueprint stuff, you know, that really isn't a problem for me. I could blather on about it for hours. I think quite a lot of the other questions you raised are really good questions. I mean, one question to kind of throw back at people, but I don't know if anyone's got any answers, is the world on consensus and kind of two recent events spring to mind about consensus. Consensus kind of was used to shut down the climate camp. Had a week-long meeting earlier this year, and I wasn't there, I'm sure everyone was there, but following the kind of reports about it in Schnooze, it just seems everyone was kind of, you know, convinced during the course of this week that they shouldn't bother doing it anymore and kind of decided to shut down. And then there's been a kind of similar thing in indie media whereby kind of a several-year campaign to try and get the UK indie media site shut down ended up convincing a whole room full of people, even though some of them didn't want to shut it down, that the only way a consensus could be reached was to agree to kind of close the project. And, you know, I don't know, these aren't very good examples of consensus decision making as far as I can see.
Well, it carried on and some people went and just carried it on anyway, didn't they? So that's the consensus sort of failed at the indie media thing, did it not? As far as I can tell, it's UK indie media is still going because a few people out of that group decided that they didn't agree with the consensus and continued anyway. Is that the case? I mean,
And this is a remarkable thing that people are talking about consensus being viable as a kind of territorial politics. You don't want to say national politics, but certainly that's the idea that it could be used in cities and within cities. And it's not even really working within these kind of small activist networks, and it's just a complete refusal to look at that. And the blueprints thing, yeah, I mean, I think you're right that, and that's why I tried to stress that there are different kind of groups and cultures and individuals, of course, where some of these things aren't an issue, and I know the whole like ZNet community, like Michael Albert, really trying to develop like economic models. And make kind of clear arguments about how the economy would work, but then he's basically denounced as not being an anarchist because he does that by certain people. So that's kind of my take, really, is not to say that there aren't any responses, but to kind of look at the way those things occur. I guess the next thing starts at 12 and it's 10:02, so if people want to kind of break and they can get off to, if anyone's got anything else to say.
You're freezing.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Yeah.